Galactic Space Union have been observing you. We have observed your efforts to penetrate our world of outer space. Earthling, I am a member of the Intergalactic Space Union. I will question you. I will determine whether you are fit to join the community of galaxies.
We stand on the threshold of a new age, the space age. It's an age that will carry us beyond the familiar frontiers, the frontiers of mere land and water and forest. This new frontier is the sky and the limitless space that lies beyond the blue, beyond even the stars that dot the heavens when the night is clear. This is the age of the vanguards, the explorers, the Sputniks, atomic power, automation. That's the frontier before us, stretching away into the future. But let's pause. Let us consider what led us to this new age, what brought us here, brought us to the age where man will be able to think, to dream, to worry less about cultivating the grain that goes into the daily bread, to cultivate the mind that will be able to see far into the future. I am Cedric Adams.
I am Bob DeHaven.
And I'm E.W. Zeebarth.
This is the seventh in a series of 12 hour-long special broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This year-long series, presented by WCCO Radio and Twin City Federal, is called Minnesota Milestones. For the next hour, we'll examine the way in which we've grown. Grown not only in the body, but in the mind. How we grew from log school to mighty institutions of education. How we came from dance hall fiddler on to the symphony orchestra. From whence came the museums and the art galleries and the thirst for knowledge? What is it that causes individuals to grow and develop? Why did they bother, these settlers in the frontier land? Why did they build schools and universities and colleges and create symphony orchestras? Why and how? This is Minnesota Milestones, Minnesota's climate for culture.
Earthling, I am a member of the Intergalactic Space Union. I will question you. I will determine whether you are fit to join the community of galaxies.
Now, just a moment. What fraternity is conducting this initiation?
In your language, Earthling, the fraternity of all galactic beings. Do not laugh, Earthling.
Oh, I am sorry, but surely in your superior wisdom you must know the lengths to which our fraternities will go in a prank or a jest, in tomfoolery or an initiation.
I have seen and I have observed. I am here to question. Yes, I know of your attempts at humor. And what is that impossible noise I hear? That earthly racket produced by thousands of straining throats.
Noise? What noise?
The noise, human, produced in that stone, bowl-shaped structure. Is this energy used for any constructive purpose?
Oh, the football game. Yes, many believe that energy is used for a constructive purpose. But let me explain. Come with me. And that's the way the game is played. Now, many feel that this activity, this recreation, may serve a useful purpose in educating our people. But, of course, there are those who disagree. Those who say the three R's are what matters.
It's high time we put a stop to the three T's in education. And the three T's are typewriting, tap dancing, and tomfoolery.
And that, in essence, was the statement made by Dean A.F. Spillhouse of the Institute of Technology at the University of Minnesota. What should our schools teach? Should it be the three R's, or should it be the three R's plus typewriting, tap dancing, and, as the critic has termed it, tomfoolery? We have lots of opinions, so let's look across the years as we trace the development of education in Minnesota, its growth from the earliest beginnings.
mission schools for Indian and half-breed children began as early as 1832. Some of Minnesota's early teachers were well-educated. John Marsh, an early teacher at Fort Snelling, was a graduate of Harvard. Minnesota owes much to these early teachers who left the comparative comfort of the East to brave the new frontier. A pioneer schoolteacher by the name of Harriet Bishop came from Vermont to open a school in St. Paul in 1847. And the only building available for a schoolhouse was made of logs chinked with mud. But Harriet Bishop made the best of it, and in an account written by herself, a story filled with dashes of humor, she told all about her fight with education in the raw.
Some wooden pins had been driven into the logs, across which rough boards were placed for seats. The luxury of a chair was accorded to the teacher. Soon all was bright and joyous. Our domicile was converted into an arbor, fragrant evergreens concealing the rude walls with their mud chinking. A friendly hen, unwilling to relinquish her claim on the ground of preoccupancy, daily placed a token of her industry in the corner and made all merry with her loud cackle and abrupt departure. Snakes sometimes obtruded their heads through the floor. Rats looked in at the open door, and dark faces were continually obscuring the windows.
And Minnesota owes much, too, to its early day legislators. They were far-seeing men who realized good schools would attract the highest type of settlers. So it was in 1849 that the first legislative assembly passed an act to establish and maintain schools. That first school law authorized a 2.5 mil tax to supply funds to pay teachers. It authorized special taxes for building schoolhouses. The author of the bill was Martin McLeod, and in his report to the legislature, he said,
"The strength and true glory of the Commonwealth must rest on the intelligence and virtue of its citizens. The diffusion of knowledge is one of those great purposes for which all should be taxed for the common good."
By 1861, the state superintendent was able to report,
"Gentlemen, we have completed a survey of the educational facilities of our state. We find 4 schools constructed of brick, 7 of stone, 220 of frame materials, and 235 schools constructed of logs, for a total of 466 schools in Minnesota at this time."
And all of these schools were elementary schools. The idea of the free public high school didn't come along until the 1870s. And why so late? Well, the prevailing sentiment of the day just didn't tolerate such a notion.
"Listen, I ain't in favor of this here high school education stuff. I ain't gone no farther than the 4th grade. Now you tell me, mister, just you tell me why the education I got ain't good enough for anybody."
And so they told him, those early day teachers and citizens with the vision-filled eyes that could see 50 years into the future. And by 1905, there were 174 state-aided high schools in Minnesota with 20,000 students enrolled.
But this was still the era of the country school, the little white one-room crossroads school. And even today, there are millions of us who can look back and remember the little white schoolhouse at the crossroads. We can still remember walking down the dusty dirt road with the green spring-seeded shoots just coming through the earth in the brown fields on the other side. And there it is now. Do you hear it? It's the school bell. And the schoolroom, I'll bet you can see that too, with the high ceiling and the tall, narrow windows and the chocolate-brown woodwork. Yes, and the blackboard up front. The teacher's desk just ahead of it on the raised platform, which was always used as a stage for the Christmas pageant. On one side, the piano with a stack of books on top, the old golden book of favorite songs, and the desks with hearts and initials carved on top, and the inkwells. The inkwells were used in those days, too. And the drowsy hum of study, and the class reciting up front, and the crisp voice of the teacher cutting through the reverie.
5th grade arithmetic. Class, rise. Stand. Pass.
And you'd march up to the front of the room, quaking, fearing the gimlet eye would stab through and learn all too soon that you hadn't prepared your lesson. And those were the days of corporal punishment. And the weapon, will you ever forget it? The 18-inch hardwood ruler. Do you remember the tense silence that settled over the room, broken only by the teacher's angry voice?
"Johnny, Johnny, I'm speaking to you.
Yes'm?
You come here. Did you dip Mary's braid in the inkwell?
Well, I...
Thought you were smart, didn't you? Didn't you?
No.
I'll make you smart.
Oh! Oh! I won't do it again!
I'll say you won't do it again. Now you go stand in the cloakroom until I tell you to come back.
Wow, I can feel the sting of that ruler yet. But I can remember something else, and perhaps you can too. It happened during the inevitable stay after school that afternoon. You worked that extra page of arithmetic problems in the silent, still schoolroom. The only sound, the ticking of the clock in its golden oak case. The pendulum swinging back and forth. Time slowly ticking away through the golden spring afternoon. And then the teacher would begin talking, all smiling and pleasant. It was then that she would instill those lessons of life that we've never forgotten. And, dismissed at last, out in the open, sunny air, you'd draw a breath, realizing your transgression had been forgiven. The slate was clean once again, and the whole world, it was wonderful.
Yes, the memory of the one-room school, the country school, will be cherished by those of us who remember. Yet, it is slowly passing. And rising up is the big school, the consolidated school, with its gymnasium and the woodworking shop, the print shop, vocational agriculture room. Bigger classes, bigger education, bigger budgets. It was back in 1901 that the Minnesota legislature passed a law providing that small rural school districts might band together to become one bigger district if they chose, or merge with a nearby school system in town. Fewer schools, bigger schools, have brought more complete education to more students. But bigger schools involve new problems, problems concerning the kind of education to be taught.
I believe the kind of education we want our children to have is the good old American education, the education that's based on reading, writing, and arithmetic. And what's happening in our schools today? I'll tell you what's happening. We're getting folk dancing, courses in sex, such rubbish as how to live together or how to boil an egg. And that our educators call common learning.
Common learning, it was the big debate there in the Minneapolis school system in the late 1940s. The superintendent of schools, Willard Goslin, launched the common learning program. And what was common learning?
To those critics of our program and to you parents who are understandably concerned, let me say this. Common learning is nothing more nor less than an attempt to educate the whole child, not just a portion of the child.
Common learning was made optional. If a parent objected, then a student did not have to attend the common learning class. But the debate over this and other aspects of progressive education continues. New ideas constantly arise, are debated, are accepted or rejected. That's the way of a democratic society.
That has been interesting, Dr. Zeebart. Most instructive. You still have not answered my question. Why do you have, as you call them, football games?
Some say because we have a democratic society, because we believe that those who desire the fun, the emotional thrill of a football game, should be allowed to see and enjoy a football game. And they believe it to be an educational experience. But for those who prefer more intellectual pursuits, there is the library. And may I suggest that we go there?
Join Dr. Zeebarth and his visitor from outer space at the library just as soon as they arrive. I wish I could ask our friend from the Intergalactic Space Union whether people in other worlds can get along without money. I suspect that making what you've got pay for what you want is a universal problem, wouldn't you agree? And since thrift is the best earthly answer to this said problem, let me take up one of my very favorite subjects, saving at Twin City Federal. Accounts at Twin City Federal are safe, down-to-earth safe, insured for safety by a permanent agency of the United States government. Now, whether you save for a trip to the moon or a home of your own, you always earn a generous return. Twin City Federal's current dividend rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly, and that's the top rate in town on insured savings. More than 100,000 thrifty earthlings make Twin City Federal home base for savings. If you'd like to join them, don't blast off. Just drive down nice and leisurely-like. Plenty of free parking for you right at Twin City Federal's door. Look for the twin clock flashing the time and the temperature at 8th and Marquette in Minneapolis, 6th and Robert, St. Paul. USA, Earth that is. Stop in. Start saving soon. Well, it looks as though Dr. Zeebarth and his guests have arrived, so let's listen in.
And in addition, there are the rare books, the microfilm, United Nations documents, as well as the films and periodicals in the Biological Medical Library, a total of nearly 2 million volumes. And though this is the largest, it's only one of the institutions of higher learning in Minnesota. There are 5 state colleges at Winona, Mankato, St. Cloud, Bemidji, and Moorhead. In addition, there are 15 private colleges and 9 junior colleges.
I must say you take your education seriously. On the one hand, I see the combat on your football field, and on the other, the serious silence of your library. This certainly is a large institution.
We think it is one of the greatest in the nation, and it is the 3rd largest.
But it was not always so. This mighty state university had its lowly, humble beginning, its period of near failure. But far-seeing legislators acted wisely again. Scarcely had Minnesota's territorial government been organized than an act was passed to create a state university. A grant of land for an endowment was secured from Congress, and in the summer of 1851, a building was erected in St. Anthony. It was merely an academy, a high school at first, but it was the beginning of the University of Minnesota. Old Main, famous Old Main, was built. Then came the Panic of 1857, followed by the Civil War. And for 10 long years, the university stood deserted and neglected. And then came a St. Anthony hardware merchant, John Sargent Pillsbury. The university owed him money, and Pillsbury went right to the Regents.
But, gentlemen, have you no business manager? Surely you must have some resource available from the legislature.
Mr. Pillsbury, we have no business manager. We do not have the funds to employ one. As for funds from the state, you are aware, sir, of the recent financial calamity and of the Civil War. We are in dire need of a businessman's assistance. The assistance of a man such as yourself.
And John Sargent Pillsbury, who had entered the room with the intention of suing the Regents, became within a few months' time a regent of the university himself. He became its chief supporter, chief pleader of its cause, and in a sense, the father of the University of Minnesota. Pillsbury went right to the legislature and brought one of its committees to view Old Main, as sorry and ill-kempt a building as ever existed in Minnesota. Squatters had settled down in its high-ceilinged rooms. And in one room, Pillsbury and the legislators found as they opened the door.
Now, this room, I informed, is intended for use as a...
Why, look, what is that? Look out! Why, those are turkeys. This room is filled with turkeys.
And the committee learned more from Pillsbury that day. The floors had been splintered by wood chopping. A portion of Old Main had been converted into a barn loft. Windows and doors sagged open, and snow and rain had driven in. At last, in 1867, John Sargent Pillsbury was able to report triumphantly to the legislature.
Gentlemen, the last claim against the university has been paid. The university's slate is clean.
Old Main was scrubbed and repaired. The squatters and the turkeys banished from its rooms. 2 teachers were employed, and the first students arrived. And Pillsbury, though he later became governor, never ceased to fight for the university which he in reality had founded. He contributed $150,000 to build the redstone building on the campus which bears his name, Pillsbury Hall. He donated his own home, which is today the residence of the university president.
It was in 1869 that William Watts Falwell, then 35 years of age, became first president of the university. His ideas for building the institution were 50 years ahead of their time, a fact which brought him into frequent conflict with his faculty and the regents. But students were slow in coming to the university. Falwell quickly determined the reason: too few secondary schools in the state. So it was he who pleaded with the legislature to supervise and support free public high schools throughout Minnesota. And when Dr. Falwell left office in 1884, the University of Minnesota was firmly established and growing. Other colleges in Minnesota had beginnings as humble as did the university. Hamlin students first attended classes on the second floor of a store building down in Red Wing back in the 1850s. A hotel was remodeled at Northfield to serve as Carleton College's first home. St. Benedict's College and St. John's College, founded up in Stearns County by the Benedictine Order, had log chapels for their first buildings. Gustavus Adolphus College at St. Peter, St. Olaf College at Northfield were founded in the 1860s. Dr. Martin Luther College at New Ulm was founded in 1884. St. Thomas Seminary, founded in St. Paul by Archbishop Ireland, became the College of St. Thomas in 1894. In 1885, McAllister College was established as a Presbyterian institution. The financial problem was universal with all colleges throughout the 1800s, and the problem of obtaining adequate funds for education remains with the university and all of the colleges to this very day. The university has had frequent battles with the legislature on the subject of money. The private colleges, even more hard-pressed, are constantly seeking new ways of raising funds.
The problem of funds and debates about the growing size have continued to plague the presidents of the University of Minnesota over the years. Cyrus Northrop, George Edgar Vincent, and especially Lotus D. Kaufman all had to answer critics who maintained the university was becoming too large. That problem exists in 1958, as President James L. Morrow seeks to expand the university westward across the Mississippi River. But in all the disputes involving the university, disputes over reorganization of the medical school, whether the university had the right to build student dormitories, President Vincent in the 1920s pointed the way for those who followed him.
The university must never waver from the position of the unimpassioned, unprejudiced seeker for the truth. All of it, and that alone.
The university, our colleges in Minnesota, and the entire educational system remain dedicated to that principle, the search for truth. Our educational system is vital in that pursuit, vital to the growth of culture in Minnesota, as we shall hear. We'll rejoin Dr. Zebarth and his guest from the Intergalactic Union after a few words from Cedric Adams.
You're listening to Climate for Culture on Minnesota Milestones, coming to you on your centennial station, St. Paul and Minneapolis, WCCO. Right now, Professor Adams is going to conduct a short seminar on saving for young parents. Would you like some help smoothing the financial way toward your youngster's college degree? Let's check some of the advantages of saving at Twin City Federal. First off, Twin City Federal accounts are safe, insured for safety by a permanent agency of the United States government. And second, generous dividends help you build college funds swiftly, more efficiently. The current rate at Twin City Federal is 3.5%, and that's the top rate in town on insured savings. Dividends are compounded quarterly, added to the accounts 4 times a year. And by saving regular sums over a period of time, you can earn up to 1% extra. Yes, indeed, if you plan to help your boy or girl through college, plan by all means to start saving at Twin City Federal. Stop in soon where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. Plenty of free parking for you right at the door.
And this building we call Northrop Memorial Auditorium. It's named in honor of one of the presidents of our university.
And what is this, Tim? What kind of contest is this?
This isn't a contest at all. These men are striving to work together in harmony. Perhaps you don't have music in the galaxies. Perhaps you aren't familiar with it. This is not music. These men are tuning their instruments, preparing to play. There was a day when Minnesotans did not have time for symphonic music, but they always enjoyed some music. In the early days, it sounded like this. Yes, there was music to enjoy every time there was a barn raising or on a Saturday night in town. And folks got together for another purpose back in pioneer days, the sing schools, as they were called. People rallied round a leader with a good, strong, natural voice, and they sang the old-time songs and they danced the old-time dances. On the day that Minnesota celebrated its 100th birthday, Whoopi John observed his 50th anniversary in the music business. In that time, he had made more than 10,000 appearances playing music like this for the people of Minnesota. Other bands playing the old-time music that settlers had brought with them from their native lands.
Are some of you humans born with the ability to play in that manner? Or do they go to school to learn?
Well, the teaching of music in the schools is of comparatively recent origin. Music departments came into being in almost all schools. One was developed at the university under the leadership of Mr. Carlisle Scott. It was in 1903, the same year the Minneapolis Symphony was founded, that Dr. F. Melius Christiansen arrived at St. Olaf to become teacher of music. He delved deeply into the rich Scandinavian music lore and brought it to the surface where all could hear and enjoy it. Dr. Christiansen developed a remarkable band at St. Olaf College, but he is remembered chiefly for his a cappella choirs, which became renowned the world over. One thing is certain. The people of Minnesota loved music. While this love has not produced great composers, it has produced much singing and playing, some of it distinguished. It was back in 1863 that St. Paul, with its music-loving German population, organized a musical society. 200 persons were interested enough to join. One of its early concerts included a Haydn symphony, no mean accomplishment for amateur musicians. Minneapolis, too, had its own musical society in the 1870s. Several had been formed over the years, but by 1900, it was the Philharmonic Club that was the most important. It had 300 members under the leadership of a gifted musician and conductor, German-born Emil Oberhofer. He enlisted the aid of a music-conscious businessman, E.L. Carpenter, who in 1903 is credited with founding the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. The symphony was the beginning of professional musicianship in Minnesota. The business interests of Minneapolis constructed the Lyceum Theater, which was for years the home of the symphony, the cultural center of Minneapolis. And there, on Friday nights, the citizens who lived in the great mansions on Lowry Hill would gather to hear the symphony, first as conducted by Oberhofer and then by Verbruggen. and the popularity of the symphony grew, creating problems for its managers. There was the necessity of playing two concerts each week in the regular season, in St. Paul on Thursday nights and in Minneapolis on Friday. By the 1920s, many were clamoring to hear the orchestra, not only the wealthy. A large concert hall was a topic of discussion for years. But it was not until Northrop Memorial Auditorium was built on the University of Minnesota campus that the symphony was able to boast a large enough hall for all who wanted to hear it. The choice was a happy one, because it occupied neutral ground and pleased both the residents of St. Paul and Minneapolis. In the early 30s, Eugene Ormandy became conductor of the symphony. Both he and Dimitri Mitropoulos succeeded in raising the standards of the Minneapolis Symphony until today, under Anto Dorati, the Minneapolis Symphony is rated one of the best in the world. The orchestra has recently completed one of the most triumphal tours in its history, a tour of Southern Europe and the Middle East.
I am a violinist with the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. Nowhere have we had the reception given us tonight in Athens. I let my imagination go. I looked back across the centuries and could see 5,000 or more Athenians and Romans witnessing on this same stage where we are now playing the hair-raising tragedies of Euripides or chuckling at the comedies of Aristophanes. When the last frenzied climax of the Ravel number had been achieved, the audience rose in a body and shouted in appreciation. Far up at the top of the steep amphitheater, men took off their shirts and waved them frantically in applause. In this country, people were saying, "We know what you Americans have in your pocketbooks. Now we want to know what you have in your minds and in your hearts." I feel that we gave a good account of ourselves here tonight in Athens.
And that's what we mean by music here on Earth, here in Minnesota.
We'll rejoin Dr. Zebarth and his guest from outer space on their tour of the arts in just about 90 seconds. Let's look now at an idea that's as old as... if it isn't our friend from the Intergalactic Space Union.
Yes, you were wondering a few moments ago whether people on other planets had money problems.
Yes, I was.
Well, I can assure you that they do. And did I hear you mention 3.5%?
Yes, that's Twin City Federal's current dividend rate.
Do you suppose they would accept a small sum from me?
Oh, I'm sure they would. Apparently, you believe in the principle of thrift.
Oh, indeed. One of our great sages, Ranul, the glowing one, once said, "Industry, perseverance, and frugality make fortune yield."
Amazing, absolutely amazing. Do you know that our own Benjamin Franklin once said that too?
How extraordinary. Now, this Twin City Federal, is it safe?
Safe as any place on Earth. Accounts are insured for safety by a permanent agency of the United States government.
Stars and garters. And 3.5%, you say?
Compounded quarterly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Adams. It has been most edifying. I must rejoin Dr. Zebarth now. 3.5%.
Well, it's been a very distinct pleasure to meet you, too. Say, do you know that I forgot to tell him about Twin City Federal's free parking? But perhaps he won't need it. Let's listen and see.
Right now, I'd like to show you these samples of another of our art forms.
Yes, I see. Yes, I like that. All these objects are like pictures of your countryside. But that picture, the one there, I don't recognize it. I don't know what it is, but I like it. Just what is it? Does such an article exist?
It exists? Yes, I would say it exists, but only in the mind of the painter. It's called abstract art.
More Minnesotans than you might imagine appreciate the kind of art that exists only in the mind of the painter, so-called modern art. The Kilbride Bradley Galleries in Minneapolis, a commercial gallery, places emphasis on the modern art form. The gallery sells more paintings on time than it does for cash. But the fine arts, that is, painting and sculpture, have been somewhat slow in developing in Minnesota. Three stages are apparent. There was the early period, the pioneer period, the period when noted artists from the East and from other lands came to sketch and to paint and to teach. Then there was the middle stage, when Minnesota artists trained here, but did their creative work outside the state, probably most of it in the East. And then we entered the third, and what probably will be the most important stage in Minnesota art, the period of Minnesota artists receiving their training in the state and doing their most important work here.
Beginning in the 1930s, artists, many of them trained in the art schools of the Twin Cities, tried and are trying to make their careers in the state. These artists are using Minnesota scenes and themes for inspiration and subject matter. In 1943, the Minnesota Sculpture Group was founded by a handful of Minnesotans interested in the plastic arts. 15 years later, in this centennial year, the Society of Minnesota Sculptors, directly descended from that original group, is bringing new awareness of sculpture to the people of this area. Collectors such as James J. Hill and T.B. Walker build up fine collections. Walker's collection may be seen today in the art center that bears his name as part of a permanent and widely varied selection of painting and sculpture. The museum also presents special exhibits and trains aspiring young artists. Where the Walker galleries concentrate on contemporary art forms, the outstanding Minneapolis Institute collection is representative of the more classic forms.
Construction is about to begin on a $1,700,000 art and cultural center in St. Paul, home of the St. Paul Gallery and School of Art. Then there's the Rochester Art Center, which features traveling exhibitions and holds classes for painters. Each summer, an artist colony for study and creation comes to life up at Grand Marais. Not far from Grand Marais, Duluth has the Tweed Art Gallery, which is now affiliated with the Duluth branch of the University of Minnesota.
Does that mean, Dr. Zeebot, that the same students must go all the way to Duluth for classes?
No, certainly not. This is actually a separate branch of the university, another campus. As a matter of fact, the university, in another sense, has divisions almost all over the state, as well as night classes, and you can even take courses by mail.
Impressive. Very impressive. You have taught me a great deal.
Minnesota has produced some noted artists in the field of architecture. Leroy S. Buffington, a pioneer architect, designed several American state capitols, some of the older buildings at the university, and many early Twin Cities homes. Together with Cass Gilbert, another Minnesota architect, he developed the idea of erecting high buildings on a structure of steel girders. Gilbert has been called the father of the modern skyscraper because of the buildings he planned. He's best known to Minnesotans for designing the present state capitol. Nationally, he's known for the Woolworth Building in New York and the old United States Supreme Court Building in Washington. Considered one of the architectural wonders of Minnesota is the National Farmers Bank in Owatonna, built back in 1907. Architect Louis Sullivan designed the building, and so well was it done that it's the only structure in Minnesota which is listed as one of the 50 most architecturally perfect structures in the entire United States. Recently, Minnesota has been in the forefront of modern church architecture and design.
In St. Paul City Hall, there's a statue, a tall figure of Mexican onyx, standing 36 feet high in the marble lobby. This statue and the entire lobby, which it dominates, is dedicated to St. Paul's young men who died fighting for their country. In the years around 1935, when this work of art was erected, it was the center of controversy. Famed Swedish sculptor Carl Millis conceived the idea of the peace statue. But St. Paul citizens had other ideas, and they wrote protestingly to the building commission.
Therefore, it is my opinion that you should obtain a fine figure of a young man from the university, a youth who will represent for all time our youth whom we seek to
honor. This is the most ridiculous waste of the taxpayers' money ever perpetrated upon the citizens of St. Paul. It is criminal, it is sinful to spend $75,000 on a piece of stone when hundreds of our citizens are standing in bread lines.
But the building commission went ahead in spite of the protests, and today, St. Paul points with pride to this unique work of art and architecture and lists it as one of the top tourist attractions in the state.
You seem to use paint and wood, stone and steel in your art, as well as sound. Are there other materials?
Why, yes, there are. Some of our most rewarding art uses man himself, whether dance or in drama.
Drama? What's drama?
Well, it's acting, a form in which men portray other men in the theater. The theater had a large place in the life of Minnesota in the early days, perhaps in some ways a larger place than it has today. The Pence Opera House opened its doors in Minneapolis in 1867, and for a quarter of a century, it was one of the best-known theaters in Minnesota. In fact, most Minnesota cities had at least one opera house where citizens enjoyed plays, operas, and minstrel shows. The village of Owatonna, back in 1888, had an opera house seating 1,000. The even smaller village of Clearwater, with 600 population, had one hall that could seat everybody in town. This was the day of the great Shakespearean actors. Public address systems were unknown then, but they were not needed.
But soft! What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon who is already sick and pale with grief, that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she. Be not her maid, since she is envious. Her vestal livery is but sick.
O Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? Deny thy father and refuse thy name, or if thou wilt not, be but sworn my love, and I'll no longer be a Capulet.
Today, you can still see in many a Minnesota town the building that used to be the opera house, now used for some other purpose, for the storage of feed and hay in some instances. Minnesotans and their good neighbors to the west enjoyed all the great Broadway shows in the heyday of Minnesota theater, and they goggled at the burlesque, too. Les Reese, Minnesota correspondent for that Bible of show business, Variety magazine, recalls those days well. He's now the dean of critics in this region, has seen them all come and go, the greats and the near greats. He saw the lights flashing on 7 big shows in Minneapolis at one time. 7 major theaters jammed with cowboys from Montana, millers and lumber magnates from the Twin Towns, gay blades and fine ladies in high-buttoned shoes and bustles. But as surely as time moves, the great houses went dark, faded one by one as flickering movie screens covered the proscenium arch. A few legit houses struggled on, but now another flickering screen, a small one in the living room, is keeping people at home. And Reese predicts an even more bleak future for theaters, both stage and screen. But the art of theater refuses to die in Minnesota. Local theater groups such as the old Log Theater in Excelsior, the Edith Bush Theater in St. Paul, and the University Theater in Minneapolis are thriving.
I'd like to see your countryside, how your people live and work.
There are small towns where the church spires probe into the evening sky, where the grain elevator stands hard by the line of rails that stretches off across the land. We have forests splotched with shadows, pines that whisper in the breezes. This is the land that Minnesotans have written about, have told the world about.
You paint a vivid picture, as vivid as some of the works of art we have seen here today. I want to see this land.
Of all the creative arts, many believe that it's the field of literature which has reached the greatest heights in Minnesota. Unquestionably, the best known of Minnesota authors was the late Sinclair Lewis, the first American and the only Minnesotan to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. Residents of Sauk Center who remember Lewis recall a gangling, pink-skinned, freckled, red-haired boy who went by the nickname of Doodle. Later, he was known as Red to most of his friends. Lewis shot into national prominence in the early 20s when he decided to write a book that he himself enjoyed, whether it sold or not. The result was Main Street, a novel based on his early days in Sauk Center. And in the book, the town was called Gopher Prairie. Lewis looked beyond the facade of neighborliness and goodwill. He dared for the first time to write of those phases of small-town life that its citizens know only too well. The jealousies, the petty backbiting and stabbing and gossip and hate and ridicule.
And when Main Street burst upon the American scene, small-town residents rose up in anger, furious at this native Minnesota son who had treated them so brutally. And yet there was a benefit. Main Streeters all over America did obtain a view of themselves they'd never seen before. And today, our small towns are spruced up, less insular, are more forward-looking and progressive and modern than they were when Sinclair Lewis dipped his pen in acid to write Main Street. When Lewis died in Rome back in 1951, he was still one of the most controversial literary figures America had ever produced.
Minnesota produced another writer whose work has been the subject of bitter controversy. F. Scott Fitzgerald was born in St. Paul and grew up there, but he left the state at an early age. Another Minnesota writer, Margaret Culkin Banning of Duluth, knew both Sinclair Lewis and Fitzgerald when they were alive.
I began in college when I wrote a little poem called Fireweed, describing the beauty of the fireweed, that flowering red among the burnt tamaracks. And it was very good for me because it got me a job on the magazine and started me off in a writing career. And so I've always used it, up to the time when I started and until the time I finished, indeed, my last book called The Convert. Of course, the background is distinctively Minnesota. It's the taconite situation. The development of taconite and one of the families concerned with it are the leading characters.
There was Ole Rolvag, who came to Minnesota from Norway as a young man, attended St. Olaf College, worked as a salesman in the summer for half the week, and spent the other half reading in small-town libraries. His masterpiece appeared in 1927. Giants in the Earth, it was called.
Belonging to an earlier period was Thorstein Veblen, who was born of Norwegian parents on a farm in Wisconsin. He moved to Minnesota when he was 8, was educated at Carleton Academy and Carleton College. He became a writer and economist, and wrote in 1899 his most important work, The Theory of the Leisure Class. One of Minnesota's outstanding living authors is James Gray, born in Minneapolis in 1899.
Then there is Frederick Manfred, born on a farm near Rock Rapids, Iowa in 1912. He has made his home in Minneapolis since 1937 and has written 10 novels, many of them attracting national attention. His early novels were published under the name Fikey Fikema.
Thomas Hagen, who died in 1949 just as he was showing great literary promise, was, as Life magazine put it, one of the bright young University of Minnesota boys whom the Eastern publishers quickly spotted. He is remembered for his book based on his World War II experiences, Mr. Roberts.
Another of the so-called bright young University of Minnesota men is Max Schulman.
I am, as I said, a professional writer of humor. And for that, I believe I have to thank the state of Minnesota. The years when I was learning my business, learning to write, were years not calculated to turn anyone into a humorist. It was depression time, the bleak, black bottom of the depression. I don't know what kind of writer I would have been if I had grown up in New York or Chicago or Pittsburgh. Maybe the grimness of life would have hit me a good deal harder. Maybe I would have turned into a serious writer, full of ferment and torment. Maybe I would still be starving to death. But in Minnesota, I could laugh, I could breathe. After high school, I went to the University of Minnesota. Why not? Tuition was only $30 a quarter at that time, and there weren't any jobs to be had anyhow. Getting to school was a matter of hitchhiking, so I went to the university. I always think that my own kids, that these kids, will have at least half the fun that I did as a kid growing up in Minnesota.
Part and parcel of the cultural climate of Minnesota is a collection in the Museum of the Minnesota Historical Society. The society was established in 1849. It's been collecting the newspapers of the state from the beginning and the private papers of the state's great men. Its collection is regarded as one of the best and most complete in the nation. And taking the historical perspective, one notable fact has become apparent in 1958 in education and the arts. Thanks to the efforts of the University of Minnesota, our private colleges, the high schools, to the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and the Walker Art Center, to the Hill Foundation, to the Minneapolis Symphony, Minnesota is now producing its own art. Minnesota writers and artists and musicians are thinking of and creating Minnesota themes. Minnesota has bridged the gap from being a cultural desert in the 1800s to becoming a cultural center in the mid-20th century, a center of learning and art which is being recognized the world around.
I am impressed with your achievements in education and the arts. But why do you do this? Why do you not devote all of your efforts to science as we do?
Well, actually, we do devote much of our effort to science, but not all. We feel that man needs more than food for his body, more than stone and steel and glass to protect him from the weather, more than satellites hurtling through intergalactic space, and more than the contributions of pure science. Man has a need, a hunger for the beautiful, a need for those things that express his feelings and teach him the feelings of other men. We call these things art.
This art, as you call it, what will you do with all this paint and this sound, with all these words and study and practice? Where will it take you in the future?
The answer to that, space visitor, we do not know, but we have found that the best in man responds to art. And today, we've reached a milestone in our cultural development. Music, painting, literature, sculpture are becoming increasingly important in the everyday life of the average man. What lies ahead? Margaret Culkin Banning expresses it this way.
In the writing of 26 published novels, 3 books of nonfiction, and hundreds of stories and short stories and articles, there has been hardly one in which Minnesota has not entered in. And this has been in two ways. Either I've been writing in the Minnesota background, or I've been writing from the Minnesota point of view. I believe that the Minnesota background has hardly been tapped. And I want to say that to the many writers who are beginning to write today. You can deal with Minnesota from any angle and get a fascinating story, a fascinating article, a fascinating historical study, if you want to do it that way. I think we have every right to be proud in this centennial year of the writing that has been built up in Minnesota. We have a few great writers and a great many good ones. But I truly believe that it's the next century in which the writers of Minnesota are going to look into their background and tell the tale of Minnesota.
The Minnesota point of view. It's a catchy phrase. It's been expressed by no less than a dozen persons. William Watts Falwell, John Sargent Pillsbury, Mariah Sanford, Sinclair Lewis, and many more. And what is the Minnesota point of view? Many things. To the painter, the Minnesota point of view may be the waves slapping against the rocky shore of Lake Superior. To the musician, to a Minnesota composer of the future, translation into pure tone of a field of waving grain. To the writer, to the poet, the Minnesota point of view, not only the landscape and the forests, it is also the people, hardy descendants of the pioneers. It is these things and more, the uniqueness of each man, which the artist makes available to all men, in all places, for all time. That is our hope. Our future will be the fulfillment of this creative work, which we have now begun.
Minnesota is a splendid place. I came here to observe. The Intergalactic Union is awaiting my report. Thank you, Dr. Zeebon, for helping me to reach a decision. You will be hearing from us.